Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Well, we had some good response to our trans program with Hannah Barnes. I was a bit anxious about it. We both were a bit anxious about it, let's be honest.
But actually, it was all very, very, I would say, pretty positive. I thought we were going to be trolled, and we weren't, because I suppose it was so measured, the discussion.
No, she was very impressive. If you've not seen or heard it, it really is worth your time. And, our own comments on our own YouTube page were very supportive of the way that we introduced it and the way we handled it. So thank you for that. I put a few things on TikTok, as I do, and it's a little wild and crazy on TikTok. So there were a few people saying, this is hate-filled rubbish. Hannah Barnes is a transphobe. You know, but I guess
that's
part of the course with this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, with social media, yeah. Anyway, our listeners are generally pretty sensible people.
We love our listeners, which is a good way to introduce comment of the month. All around the world, thousands of people are trembling in anticipation to discover the comment of the month. So shall I tell you who it is?
Yes, and they get a mug, don't they?
This month I chose, because Andrew grabbed the honours last time. I need to find it. Hang on a minute. Pause. Françoise, I pronounce your name, Lermite, from Belgium. Thank you very much for writing to us. In fact, not only did you write to us, you put up a lovely comment about baking. You listened to us while you were baking, which we thought was very lovely. And then you wrote us a lovely email all about the Belgian royal family as the possible program. So, Françoise, be in touch. You can email us, well, you already have. You can email us again and send us your address in beautiful Belgium, and we'll get you one of our lovely mugs. Maybe we should translate it into French. Let us know. Yes, we could do that. We
have an international range. Yes. And Jan White's been sending a lot of very helpful comments.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Jan.
So it's really nice to have this response, and it's certainly giving us some good ideas. And she's, I think, following up on one of her suggestions to find a speaker. So it's becoming a real community.
It is a community. That's what we want to do, build a community. Well, the other story, you know, we missed last week, and somebody reminded me of this. You know, we love our royal scandals. The Rebel Wilson allegations. I don't know if you saw this, Andrew. Rebel Wilson, the Australian actress, she's already stirred up one row by criticising Sacha Baron Cohen, but now she's alleged that a famous royal, who she doesn't name, but says was 15th or 16th in line to the throne, invited her to a sex party, a sex and drugs party, at some tech billionaire's ranch. So everybody's furiously speculating. She said it was just outside Los Angeles, and it was, 15th or 20th, whatever that means, in line to the British throne, and it was about 10 years ago. So come on, Andrew, you must have a theory.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, 15th and 20th, if it's in that region, it does identify a number of people. I think we've got to look at who might have gone to Los Angeles at that time. And there is one obvious candidate who spent a lot of time in Los Angeles at that time who enjoyed going to sex parties.
Oh, Andrew, you mean?
Yeah, I think he's the most likely candidate.
Wouldn't he be a bit old? I was going to say, wouldn't he be a bit old for that? But then I realise how ridiculous that sounds.
He's got very white taste.
Beatrice and Eugenie, I mean, they had some pretty fast friends at that time.
Yes, indeed. Well, indeed, one of the boyfriends of Beatrice has just been found dead of a drugs overdose.
Yeah, that was terribly sad.
So, you know, it's they do mix with some pretty strange people. So I don't know. I mean, Rebel's sort of teasing everyone. No one's really come forward with a candidate. And, I mean, we can only speculate. But
nobody invites me to sex orgies anymore. Not for months.
Well, not for months. Who knows?
We have a fairly quiet life down here in the southwest suburbs. We do play bridge with our mother-in-law, so that's much more fun.
Right. Well, that's the highlight of the week, isn't it? That and the podcast. Like, that's
that and the podcast, yes. That's, my life is racy enough. Clive Irving is back.
Yes. Yes, we always enjoy having Clive.
Let's do.
Different perspective. He's very much on side with Harry, and in this case I am too, because it's the hacking allegations, and he's really holding out Harry for I mean, I don't think he'll go to court, but he's certainly holding out for a big settlement.
Yes, we have if you've listened to any of our Lady Colin Campbell shows, we've had plenty of opportunity on here to say disparaging things about Harry and Meghan, but actually on the question of Harry's pursuit of the British tabloids over hacking, I think we're very on side, and certainly Clive Irving is. Clive is a very experienced British journalist and editor. He's worked numerous newspapers. He's now in America working on the Daily Beast. He's seen the rise and the fall of the tabloids, and he's a particular critic of the Murdoch-owned tabloids, and indeed Murdoch's influence in other countries through Fox News in America and through his newspapers in Australia. So he likes the idea that Harry is taking on Rupert Murdoch in court, and he's going to talk about that. I don't know if you saw, though, Hugh Grant was in the same case or an associated case, and he settled. And he put a very interesting post up on social media saying he settled because he couldn't afford to keep fighting, and they made him a very generous offer. And apparently this is what Murdoch organization has often done in the past. And when it looks like Rupert might have to come into court to give evidence, they say, OK, guys, let's settle this out of court. Here's £1 million. You know, do you want to take the risk of fighting anymore and possibly losing loads of money, or do you want £1 million?
Well, I think that's one of the terrible things, that even if you win, your cost may be higher than any award that you receive. And we actually have David Hooper coming up talking about, in effect, these slaps, rich people who use the courts to suppress legitimate questions and investigation. But Harry is one of the few people who's got the money to take Murdoch all the way.
Well, I really want to talk to Clive about this, because I don't know if anybody remembers, right at the beginning of the of this podcast, we had my friend Patrick Jeffson on. And Patrick was Diana's only private secretary, a most successful advisor. And he still feels some of the things that Harry feels about the things that were done to Diana by the press, and the press working in a kind of alliance with Prince Charles's court. It seems wrong to talk about Charles in a negative way. Now we know he's seriously ill, but this, I think, is the key to Harry. I've said this before. Harry was around during this time, and he saw his mother's memory traduced, people being given help to attack her when the focus seemed to be not to help him, but obviously to help his father get his reputation back and to make the public love Camilla. And this was a time that was a very dark time. Patrick, if you go back to that interview, he wrote a book, a very positive book about Diana, and he was absolutely slammed for it. In fact, William and Harry themselves, they were still children, were put in front of the press to attack him, in front of TV to attack him. And yet, at the exact same time, Charles's men were helping other writers write really nasty things about Diana. And Harry knows this. Diana's brother knows this. And it is one of the great kind of dark clouds, I think, that still hangs over Charles. And the real reason, whatever you think of Spare, and I think a lot of it is rubbish, but it is the real deep reason why Harry is so anti the spin operation that he thinks still continues.
I mean, wasn't material leaked about Patrick's private life to the newspapers? It's a pretty ruthless operation, this media manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, it was 20 years ago, but you know, I made a film with Patrick, so I know the story inside out. And at the end, he directly addresses Charles. I mean, he knew these people really well. He knew William and Harry. And he said to Charles, you need to remember, Ich Dien is on the crest of the Prince of Wales. And he says, it means I serve. It doesn't mean I spin. That's what he said.
And this right, to me, it's very telling. Gosh. Well, I think I do recommend going back to that Patrick Jeffson interview. And I mean, you've made the point that all these stories have a long, a part of a much longer trajectory. They're not just the things that appear out of thin air. You know, your work on Diana, I think, has helped change people's view of Diana.
Yeah, it's such a tangled web, really. We've had lots of people on here talking about the Netflix series and Spare. You know, and I think we both agree with Valentine Lowe. A really big part of this was Meghan was just impossible. She was really, really difficult to her staff. And that started all the rows and a lot of everything that followed grows from that. But I think probably long before he even met Meghan, Harry had this inside him, this anger, which is now coming out. And I think he has some justification for it. And I suspect Clive will agree with me.
Well, also, of course, we've had some new disclosures about the bullying claims. Various people like Samantha Cohen, who worked for the Royals, have come forward to confirm the stories that Valentine broke. And I know from my own experience that one of the reasons they want to shut the story down is they would have to also investigate Andrew, who, again, has had a series of allegations against him made by members of staff because of his rudeness and behavior. You know, it's one of those stories where we may eventually get some of the truth, but I think a lot of it will be suppressed.
Yeah. No, I suspect you are right. All right. Well, I've had my weekly rant. Shall we go to Clive?
Let's go to Clive.
Okay. Come in, America. Clive, thank you very much for giving us a second chance.
Yes, it's nice to be back again with you guys. It's fun.
Good. Well, it's fun for us too, and I particularly wanted to talk to you today about the history of hacking, but also I think the history of the sort of rise and fall and maybe the end of kind of tabloid power, and in particular the power of the Murdoch tabloids in this country, perhaps more than this country, in the course of our careers.
Certainly a course of my career, because I first directly encountered a tabloid on my appearance in Fleet Street in 1955 when I worked for the Daily Sketch, which was one of the lesser tabloids. It was owned by the Mail Group. It was their kind of token tabloid. They never really put much money into it. It was quite underfunded, and it was always overpowered by the Daily Mirror, clearly. But the thing I loved about it as a kind of apprentice in journalism in 1955 was that it was so, in a way, impromptu and invented that it wasn't this is the key to the whole tabloid thing, really, is you don't follow the news agenda as other people would. You try to find some way of you know, to use the old term scoop, but you've got to find something that's more original. So each day there would be this conference at the Daily Sketch about what would be the weirdest story that we could possibly run today. So it broke away from the pattern of the general news, and people got kind of rewarded for the most outrageous, but also the unscrupulousness of some of it too struck me, because I remember there was a vicar who was accused of killing off some of his parishioners. I've forgotten his name now. Anyway, the thing is that one of the Daily Sketch reporters descended on this guy. This is kind of relevant to what went on later. Descended on this guy's house at midnight, And it was somewhere in the West Country, and he knocked on the door, and the vicar came to the door. This it was a vicar who was about to be defrocked, and this guy shone a light in his face and said, he said his name and said, "You have been located by the Daily Sketch. I now want you to confess," you know, and it was that was kind of wild journalism of that time.
No, it's funny, the word tabloid has become very pejorative.
Yes.
In the last few decades, but it wasn't originally at all. It was a byword for clever, for maybe sometimes yes. radical, certainly for being inventive, being a little bit cheeky and tweaking the nose of the powers that be. People loved that about those newspapers.
The classic of that period of tabloids was certainly the Daily Mirror under Hugh Cudlip.
How do we get from that to the sort of great hacking crisis? The sort of cruelty of the tabloid, and I think in particular the News of the World, maybe the Sun, sometimes also the Mirror. The idea of getting a story at any expense and getting people seemed to kind of grow in the 80s and 90s. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. That's what was my perspective.
That happened entirely because of Rupert Murdoch's appearance. Now, so the Mirror, and it involves Hugh Cudlip's worst moment, I think, as he explained to me afterwards. They had a paper called The Sun, and it was a broadsheet. It replaced the Daily Herald, which was the official Labour newspaper. Then they replaced it with The Sun, and it was not a success. They couldn't do a straight broadsheet. They didn't have it in them. So Rupert came along. He was looking for some vehicle to launch his own daily paper. And he bought the tabloid version of The Sun and then relaunched it as The Sun that we know. And so there's your tipping point. There's once Murdoch gets his hands on the medium of the tabloid, at first it had a kind of provincial Australian feel about it. It had a lot of Australian things in it, which were not really suited to the British market. But he's a quick learner, and he learned. And that the ruthlessness that you talked about began with Kelvin McKenzie, who was the real first total. He could execute more completely Murdoch's approach to newspapers than Murdoch could himself. He sort of understood. He was the voice between the newspaper and the reader, and so the front page became very tabloid with those dramatic big black headlines, and they went more and more into the. This is where it fuses with another movement, which is very fundamental to the story that we're discussing, which is celebrity journalism had been globalized by that point. And when I say celebrity, that began to include, well, it already included the royal family, clearly, because they were being celebritized, if there's such a word, at that point. And it included politicians. And when you get scandals like the Jeremy Thorpe scandal, for example, which was full of very raw material, which they could exploit. It's like they're designing the future of what we've seen now without knowing they were doing that. So you go from the debasement of journalism under Murdoch and The Sun to the criminalization of journalism under Hacking, because that was another fatal step. And it was a fever, you know, in about 1995 and onwards, but it really got going after the year 2000. It was like a industrialization of celebrity pursuits, and once they understood that they could do this hacking technically, then it was out of the box, and had its most complete and unregulated run in The Sun.
News of the World, maybe.
News of the World. And then it transferred to The Sun.
Well, of course, Prince Harry, and we should get to him, because he's one of the reasons we're having this conversation. For all the reasons we all understand, he's made a personal issue out of this. It's his crusade, one of his crusades, to take on the papers, not just The Sun and the News of the World, the Mirror as well.
And the Daily Mail.
And you and I were working in this industry. I'm sure Andrew was agenting and writing books. I was writing a biography of Diana in about 1999, 2000.
Yeah.
And all journalists talked about hacking. They boasted about hacking. Then it was just a tool of the trade. And by this stage, there was such kudos attached to any hack who could get his foot in the door, go through a dustbin. You know, all bets were off. And the people were celebrated. They felt no shame.
Right.
They were just good at their jobs. And it was really only when it all came crashing down that a lot of them thought, do you know what? We went way too far. I mean, this is just me spouting off. You may disagree.
You've got to remember what a newsroom was like under those conditions. That the News of the World newsroom, it never happened in my days on the news, but they had a kind of ranking system for the reporters. That there was a chart on the wall saying who'd got how many scoops per week, and it was a real rat race of bottom fishers. Confusing metaphors, rats and fishes, but seems suitable to me. and imagine the pressure they were under. What you were describing there is not just the madness and the enthusiasm of it, but the terror of it, the terror of being expected to deliver at that rate of scoop every week.
But presumably there was money in this too. I mean, there were salaries were going up, there were circulation wars. I mean, there was a lot more money around to pay people, and presumably this was also helped by technology. I mean, hacking wouldn't really have been possible without mobile phones, for example.
Right. So, of course, it was all about money because it was all about circulation. And that's when the papers, the tabloids reached their peak circulation numbers on during the hacking thing. So it was like an intoxicant. They were so intoxicated with the efficacy of it, if you like, that it worked, that it was a kind of every day people would be drawn to these tabloids for the stories that they were breaking, the stories that were obtained through hacking, all the private stuff that was coming out. I mean, think of the victims were people like Hugh Grant is a classic case, for example. And he's still one of the major litigants in the same case that Harry is bringing against Mirror Group newspapers. And Elizabeth Hurley, Guy Ritchie, or people like that were among the early hits of the tabloid scandals.
And Harry, for all reasons, well, you know, obvious reasons, as we just said, he has a particular reason to go after these people. And he also alleges at the absolute peak of all this, I think, around the turn of the century, that the palace was so frightened of the press that they would do deals with them. This is at the heart of his criticism of his father and William's approach to the way they've handled press relations. Rather than fighting back, they would do a deal, they would leak stories, sometimes stories against other royals, so as that they would go easy, say, on Camilla. I mean, this is what his book's about, and he clearly absolutely believes that those kind of dirty deals were going on. Do you think he's right?
Yeah, he was right, because that was part of the palace communications attitude, that it was better to sleep with the devil than oppose the devil. So that's what they were doing. In Harry's own phrase, he used that phrase, they were sleeping with the devil. And that was not new, really. It's a kind of extension of the policy of the palace all along, that it's better to mediate with these guys and come to some kind of trade-off that will give you a certain amount of information each day if you lay off of the invasions of privacy. That was basically what it was. So it was effective for a while, but then it completely failed at the point of impact when the tabloids, when the hacking started, because the stuff the hackers were getting was so juicy. I mean, obviously, conversations between the phone call between Charles and Camilla, the notorious phone call, that was irresistible.
Yes. There was also the phone call between Diana and her supposed boyfriend, I mean, which came because sort of got leaked about the same time. It suggests that people and waiting, but they were clearly playing off people, weren't they? They were favoured royals, shall we say, and others like Harry, who was sort of collateral damage.
Yeah, that's right. There's always been I think Harry realised this early on, and he's been the only one, I think, who's taken the courageous path of trying to shut down the whole ethical collapse, the whole, or to describe, if you like, he's described the whole ethical collapse of the tabloids. And I think you guys probably agree with this, that part of the decline of the British newspaper has been entirely due to the stain that's been left by this.
Interesting. Well, I mean, it brings us to Piers Morgan, of course, because Harry is convinced that Piers Morgan knew about hacking. Piers Morgan denies it, and he turns the tables on Harry and says, hang on a minute, mate, you've been revealing your secrets. You've been making money and selling books on your secrets, so you're a hypocrite. And then everybody gets very angry. But I guess at the very bottom of all this was the minute they went too far.
That was a ridiculous defence, because obviously Harry wasn't invading anybody's privacy. He was invading his own privacy, if you like. And he decided what he would say and what he wouldn't say.
Well, he was invading his brother's and father's privacy. I don't think that's right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's.
Yeah. There's a right and wrong on all sides on this one. And it's very hard for anybody to be kind of the white knight in all of it. But one thing I think we can all agree on is it all came to a head with Millie Dowler. Nobody would ever defend what they did over that poor girl and her family. And that was such a shock to the system that it nearly broke Murdoch, didn't it? It certainly ended one of Britain's most notorious newspapers within months.
Should we explain what Millie Dowler, the hacking was there, Phil? So for the Americans and Australian listeners.
Well,
yes.
Clive, you tell the story, because it's a great story.
Well, Millie Dowler was murdered. How old? I think she was about 11 or 12. A very young girl was murdered. And somehow a hacker got into her cell phone. That's correct, isn't it?
And you could easily do it because the factory settings hadn't been changed, I think.
That's right, yeah. And so they used that information in a story. Now, it's interesting that Nick Davis, who broke the story in The Guardian, has never revealed the name of the person who tipped him off about this. That he was tipped off by someone, I think maybe a cop. One of his police contacts tipped him off, so he never got that story without that tip. And in fact, he tells them of when he was walking, I think he was walking down the Strand or somewhere, and he got a call tipping him off about that. So that was when that was exposed. That was so gut wrenching and outlandishly awful and morally reprehensible that Murdoch never. Or the Murdoch papers never recovered from that particular episode. And let's just discuss for a moment the deniability issue, which is very big amongst those who said they didn't know it was going on, from Rupert Murdoch down in the newsgroup newspapers. And this persists to this day, that the idea that to anyone who's worked in a newspaper, it seemed, let's put it gently, highly unlikely that the man who owns the newspaper doesn't know that this is the way the stories are being collected. It seemed highly unlikely that Rebecca Brooks, who was the editor of successively of the News of the World and then The Sun, who was known for being watching budgets very tightly, it's always a question of follow the money. The hacking, and I think I was told about the cases still currently in motion against Mirror Group newspapers, that the biggest underwritten part of this litigation, and it's coming out in discovery over the past year, I think, in the last cases to come up through the courts, the biggest item in discovery is that they've been able to discover the whole cover-up process that what went on to protect Brooks and Murdoch himself and Piers Morgan and on the Mirror and so on. But the evidence on the Mirror Group newspapers, on the News Group newspapers, which means basically the News of the World stuff and later The Sun, they dispute that The Sun was doing this, but they were, I'm sure. But the discovery process is now able to describe widespread destruction of hard drives before the cops got there, and the destruction of a lot of emails, but actually those emails weren't destroyed. They've been recovered in some way. And so there's a, I think there's a trove of emails that will be used to prove without doubt that Murdoch had knowledge of what was going on, and so did Brooks had knowledge of what was going on.
Well, we should say that.
So what will happen?
As of now, those people have not been proved of it. And,
but so what will happen if under this discovery, with this new information, are we like to see new trials? Because after all, Rebecca Brooks has been acquitted.
Yeah, no, that's different because she was acquitted on a completely different count, and that's true. And when I wrote that a year ago, actually, in the Daily Beast, that she was taking charge of the Mirror Group, the News Group litigation. She issued an immediate denial and said that she was not involved with the lawyers in the litigation. The lawyers were entirely independent in handling it. So I had to make that correction. I'm fascinated by Rebecca Brooks because I took offence at parts of Nick Davis's book in that he adopted the misogynist newsroom standards of describing a woman doing something that all the men did as though it was inappropriate for a woman to do it. He said that she rose up through the ranks of the newspaper business because she was very good at nurturing contacts and sweet-talking cops and ingratiating her way into the political class and being respected. That apparently, according to Nick, the tone he took in the book was inappropriate for a woman, but it was, of course, what everybody. So I had a more than a modicum of sympathy for her for being described like that. Also, I think she was a woman in a very ruthless men's world, and she proved herself to be a very able and effective newspaper executive, which she still is, actually. She, in the last 5 years or so, she's demonstrated that she really understands the new ecology of the digital media as opposed to print media. She's managed the transition of the newspapers and the Sunday Times and the Times particularly well away from print and into digital, very successfully done that. So I don't want to in any way diminish her professionalism. It's just that it's impossible, and in fact, for that reason, it's harder for us to believe that she could be completely unaware of the hacking when it was going on, because she was neither negligent nor
inattentive.
Well, she sounds like she's very hands-on, and if you're hands-on, you know what's going on.
She earned Murdoch's respect very early on for being hands-on, and she earned his respect for being a very tough person and able to hold her own against all these red-top, muscle-bound reporters.
Do you think it's a bad thing, though, in some ways? Because, you know, there's less investigative journalism going on. I mean, these papers like News of the World did hold the rich and powerful to account.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
And that's not really happening now to the same degree.
That's a very interesting point, Andrew. I'd be careful with that one, because the rich and powerful are constantly being exposed in other mediums, aren't they? I mean, don't they get social media is leaking a lot of stuff that leads to very powerful pieces about company, well, the mismanagement of companies. I would say this, though, about that, Andrew, that the papers that are supposed to be monitoring business ethics and corporate ethics don't seem to be doing a very good job in the UK. They do a better job of it here, I think. And so I think there may be something in what you say that the hound dog is missing.
I mean, we've got Private Eye, but I think a lot of the papers just go for clickbait. It's a lot easier, particularly with slaps and other legal problems that can come. And so I just wonder if in some ways we've lost out on that, or maybe the public doesn't care. You know, think of the post office scandal. It took a drama to yes. get people to focus on it, to get politicians to do anything. And we know week after week, there's a scandal and people just brush it off and ignore it and move on.
I think that's a very important point you made, because the post office story is a classic case of that, that it went, you know, it was being reported for 3 or 4 years and no one took any notice, but it took the way that you synthesized it as a drama. In other words, you brought it home in immediately personal terms as a drama of suffering and abuse of power in a way that you can't do in print. And it instantly, almost overnight, had a redemptive effect. It woke people up.
Do you sorry, I was going back to Harry and his court cases, because we haven't seen much coverage of this in the last few months, but it's still ticking away. Do you think there's something in what Harry's doing, and as you mentioned, he's supported by some other celebrities as well, that might yet really damage Murdoch? Or do you think he's pretty much manoeuvred himself away from all that now by closing down the News of the World and making sure that something's disappeared?
I think the question is, will Harry settle out of court? And the conventional wisdom is that he's the only one of the litigants who's got the money not to settle out of court, that everyone else hasn't got the money to pay the legal fees, to persist and persist and persist, and that Harry is the only one who has and is prepared to do that, because he wants to see Rupert Murdoch as a witness. Murdoch's never appeared as a witness. He didn't appear. He was about to appear in the Dominion case. And in fact, he was deposed last November, by the way, in the Smartmatic case, which is the one where the Smartmatic also a massive libel action like Dominion, because they were libeled by Fox News.
Oh, this is Fox News on the election and the allegations about the voting machines.
That's right. Yes. So, and they're asking for, what is it, the number? I've got it, $2.7 billion in damages. So they're never going to get that amount, but obviously you over-demand in order to get, I mean, Dominion got $87 billion. That's quite a lot of money out of Murdoch. And so the fascinating thing to me is there are hundreds of cases still standing in this line. Hacking cases have come in five waves. The fourth wave ended last year, and the next wave is due in court in January next year, January 2025. So this is the turning point for Murdoch. It's the merging of Murdoch's last years and Harry's revenge on the Red Tops converging now. So that if this threat hangs over news group newspapers, that Rupert will have to go into the dock, as he would. It would do it in the Smartmatic case too. Are they going to settle another case out of court just to protect him or not?
Gosh, what's this
space? Is the Harry case different for the Daily Mail and News Group and others, or is it all basically the same sort of case, just with different people?
Well, that raises an interesting point, because I've never felt the Daily Mail was a tabloid. It's not a red top. It's never been a red top. The Daily Mail is an outlier in these cases. It's an outlier in the sense of the kind of newspaper it is, because it doesn't have the puerility of the red tops. It's not a lowest common denominator tabloid, as they are, as the Sun is, and the News of the World was, and the Daily Mirror was. In a sense, it's a serious paper because it's the paper of the Little Englanders and the Brexiters, and you know, it has a constituency, a serious political constituency of its own. And as much as I think it's nuts, because it was the first popular newspaper in the world, really, when it was invented in the 1890s, under a guy who became Northcliffe. I take it separately from the red tops. I think of it separately, and I therefore wonder why it got sucked into this hacking thing, which it clearly did at one point, because it was competing in the celebrity. It's always competed in the celebrity news business, but it found itself doing the same dirty tricks that the red tops are doing while holding its nose. Now, I think that what I was told by somebody involved in all this litigation is that something happened a couple of months ago regarding the Mail case, which is interesting, that the litigants wanted to get at the ledgers that under the Leveson inquiry, it was revealed that the Daily Mail had ledgers in which it kept the payments they made to private investigators, to what the Americans call gumshoes, and that was proof that they were using private investigators to do this kind of stuff, the hacking. And they made the litigants in these last cases made an application to get the information in those ledgers, and it was turned down by a judge. And so they went and made an appeal to the government. And this is interesting, that the Home Secretary and the Culture Secretary came down on the side of Harry and the litigants and said that they should be given access to the ledgers, so they are, because they're part of the evidence to Leveson, so they can be released by the government. I don't know exactly which department has the job of releasing them, but they've now, in the last couple of months, been given access to those ledgers, which will reveal payments made to private investigators. Now, this is the ticking bomb under all these cases, not just the Daily Mail, but the Mirror Group. The Mirror is settled now, but the remaining cases in the News Group, if you can pin down private investigators, and the private investigators lead us to something else too, which is the cops, which lead us to the bent cops who collaborated particularly with the News of the World and the Sun. They had a very clear, as you know, some Scotland Yard people had a very clear, much too close relationship with the News of the World and the Sun. And so when it came to the discovery process and finding out that all those hard drives had been destroyed and the emails had gone missing, the cops were, let me say, a little less than energetic in going into that stuff.
It's scandalous, isn't it?
It suggests that also the Conservatives know they're going to lose the election, because they wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of a News Group, for example, before an election. But where do you draw the line between what is legitimate sort of good journalism, and that might include employing a gumshoe, and going over into something which is illegal? I mean, is it a narrow line, or is it pretty clear cut for a journalist?
No, it's not clear cut, Andrew, for the reason you stated, that I don't ever remember that the Sunday Times in the glorious days of the Insight team of ever using private investigators. What we did use were technical experts. We summoned technical experts on technical points. And particularly with, as Harry Evans did with thalidomide, had lots of medical. They weren't gumshoes. They were hired to provide the technical knowledge and erudition that obviously general journalists don't have. So this is a separate issue that you've raised here, and I think that you can be ethical and use a private investigator, because it depends in the end on the use you make of the information that the investigator gets, because as an editor, you can say, no, I can't use that, because it would be disgraceful to use that. But on the other hand, it can provide you with things that you can use to understand a story, to understand, for example, a timeline and the number of characters involved and who did what, whose responsibility it was to do this and that kind of stuff. So it is ethical to use private investigators on that level.
It's one of the problems that data protection rules now make it much more difficult to write about people in the way that people used to. That's an extra factor.
Yeah, well, that's another minefield that you have to navigate around to understand how that works.
And things.
And my other question, Michael Crick was talking about that a few months ago to us.
Well, I mean, we're seeing reclosure of documents, for example, in archives, because though they may be the exemptions of the FOI don't apply, now they've got data protection rules that have come into play. So we have going backwards. But one other interesting question about the way that the royal family or the palace works with the press. Do you think that relationship has changed? I mean, you said there was a point where they basically worked together, then they realized that they were never going to give them enough. So is there a new technique now that's used, or is there still games playing going on?
I think there are games being played going on, but I think that the palace policy hasn't fundamentally, ethically altered it's they prefer to mediate rather than oppose, and so the effectiveness of what the palace does depends entirely on how well they're able to satisfy the hunger on a daily basis, and it depends on all the tidbits they're allowed to reveal. And so you get this terrible habit, you can see it every day, it drives me nuts, of a friend of the prince, a friend of Camilla's, or a friend of the king's. It's always one person removed being quoted. And so they've lined up all these dummies who feed them these useless and useless tidbits of information, for which they fight over all these morsels, useless morsels of information they feed. And so I think there's a very serious thing going on right now about this, which is how much the public is entitled to know about the king's illness, and by admirably going one foot out and saying he got cancer, that was very good. But stopping right there has caused an enormous, if you like, a dam of questions being held back. Well, what kind of cancer? How serious is it? And what is the outcome going to be? These are all legitimate questions. Can anyone, this is a question they should answer, because it's not intrusive in my view. Can anyone at the moment know the outcome? Is any medical authority in a position to tell us whether the outcome is good, bad, or unknown? I think that would be useful to know.
Because it's the uncertainty, which I suppose is the problem. But I mean, we had Valentine Lowe a few weeks ago talking about the Kate picture. I mean, do you think that they were wrong-footed there, that they were on the back foot all the way through, until she made her broadcast? Or do you think, again, there were legitimate reasons for her to keep her private medical information private?
I think that they weren't wrong at all. I think that once William knew, I think February the 17th, when he cancelled going to that memorial service for his godfather, once he knew that it was cancer, they had to do between them a lot of things to protect her until they were ready to talk about it. They first of all had to deal with the children, and that was obviously going to be, now you don't want the whole herd of journalists descending on them at that moment when they discover it. The children are going to, they're the most vulnerable, and they're going to take time to get used to the idea of what's happened to their mother. And the same thing is going on with the king at the same time, so it's a critical situation. So, and I think, I don't know if you know the answer to this question, Andrew. You might. You know, is there a plan B to how to act when a member of the royals is not dead but is taken out, effectively removed from public duties until they're well again? There must be. Isn't there a backup plan? Because William is part of that backup plan, obviously, in terms of the king. But now there needs to be a backup plan for William, because he's also limited in the amount of time he can spend doing public duties. There must be some... I get a feeling that all this is strangely under-rehearsed by them, that they weren't ready for it.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the problem is they haven't got enough reserves to play. The problem is the reserves they've got to choose from, like Beatrice and Eugenie. The king's not very keen on choosing.
No.
So they aren't problems. But I mean, how do you feel about the slimmed down monarchy? Because I mean, that seems to be a big a debate now. Is it too slimmed down, or are we just expecting too much on the royal family?
Well, it's not a slimmed down monarchy in any bloody way at all, honestly. Because what's not slimmed? I don't know what the household staffing. And the number of people dealing with these problems, whether that's been cut or not, I doubt it.
Protection costs have been cut, though. A lot of them don't get protection.
Well, yeah, I know, but I think that's a different issue about the managing of the we're talking about the communications managing. And by talking about that, we are talking about the connection between the throne and the people. And this is the thing you really have to watch, because it's changed after the Queen. The communication, the connection of the throne with the people is of a different order. Nothing like of the same strength as it was under the Queen. I don't want to personalise that too much on Charles, but it's a real matter. The feel and the role of the monarchy, the feel of it, the public feel of it, has undergone a change. And you can see this by the... I thought at one point we might be going back to 18th century cartoon-like disrespect for the monarchy, that there was such a healthy disrespect for the monarchy until the age of genuflection came in the 19th century, and all the satire that used to thrive so much in London was shut down. The satire of the royals was shut down in the 19th century by Victorian attitudes towards... it was bigger than the monarchy. It was the whole idea of a stratified social system, in which it starts at the bottom and goes up, and at the top you had the monarchy, and so you could never say anything critical of the monarchy. And that lasted for a very long while, and that's now breaking down, I think, very visibly. Do you feel that?
Yes, I think it has to. I mean, I think things are breaking down in that respect. Yes, I don't know about you, Phil.
Well, the whole
we had my friend Tim Clayton on the podcast last year talking about Gilray and that golden age of satire and mockery and very, very sort of scatological and sexual criticism of these people. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to get that, but I think what we are getting though is a willingness to say things about the current setup that would never have been said about the Queen, because they're not the Queen, and they're just saying
I mean, Tina Brown last week has been quite forthright talking about what's going on, and I mean, she's a pretty establishment figure.
Yeah, and it's all part of the passing of deference. Generally, the passing of deference towards politicians and deference towards that. In a way, I think the royal family is the last piece of deference to go. Automatic knee-jerk deference is no longer there, and it shouldn't be there, really.
I think there's a lot of love for Kate and for William. You know, that's people tend to take their side in the great standoff with Harry and Meghan. I'm aware that you perhaps don't, Clive, but I think most British people do. And I think if Kate, the way she's had a statement about her health, has got a lot of love and respect for her.
I think you've misrepresented my view here, okay? I'm very pro-Harry and Meghan. I think they've been very, very abused, but I'm also very pro of Kate. I think she's become a very sympathetic figure. She's very, very dedicated, both as a most important thing about Kate is her dedication to make her family feel as natural in their lives as they possibly can within the competing stresses of the gilded cage. Mm-hmm. They are in a gilded cage, but she's worked very hard to keep them from feeling that way. And I think she's worked harder than William in that respect, because in a way she's come from the outside in a way that William didn't come from the outside. And William's much more under the influence of his father than Kate's ever been. So
true.
I think she's less hidebound by tradition. And what do you think, I mean, will this change, for example, the relationship between the king and Harry? I mean, are we going to see closer sort of coming together, the spat sort of going away, or has it really made no difference that some?
Well, I wrote a piece about this last week on the Daily Beast, saying that I hoped it does make a huge difference. This whole spat is so trivial, and in a way, I feel so pointless. And anyone who's had family quarrels between siblings knows this, that in the end, it just wastes a lot of people's emotional energy, and it's. At this point in the career of William and the career of Harry and the life ahead of them as the next generation of the royal family, they just got to get that out of the system. It is so petty and so irrelevant to all the pressures that are on them. Now, are they capable of a lasting reconciliation? There's a lot going on behind the scenes at the moment that we don't know toward that end. But it plays into something else that I felt about Harry and Meghan. Harry and Meghan were potentially great assets to the throne. They were a very attractive couple. They had the Diana-like quality of being able to communicate with people in a very natural and instantaneous, without the restraints being placed on William, because they didn't need those restraints that were placed on him. They had a different zone of activity and a freer zone of activity. So they were a really great asset, for example, that could have been used in dealing with the Commonwealth and with Africa.
I agree.
Like Heineken.
Yeah, so why can't they come back?
They reached bits that others couldn't.
That's right, they did, yeah. And so why can't they come? Is it completely mad of me to suggest that why can't they come back in and be the... They're outside the country. They do all the work that they can do from outside the country on behalf of the royal family. They can still go places. They're not working royals technically anymore. They've dropped that role. They should get that role back again.
Yeah, we have working from home in business.
We'll
Why can't we have working
point.
From home as a royal? But, I mean, yeah. Does this reconciliation mean that Andrew's going to come back within the fold? I mean, he's clearly got a higher profile now because he's, you know, number eight senior royal at certain events like the Easter service.
Not after Netflix this Friday, mate. Once they see
them. or the next one, or whatever.
Or Andrew's book.
Yes.
This Andrew's book. Oh, it's fantastic to talk to you. I mean, I do think it's, yeah, I suspect that there will be an effort to make a reconciliation if the two blokes themselves can just break the barrier, you know, as you say, we've all had family rounds.
Yeah.
It is possible. Yeah. It is possible to get beyond them, and I think this is a perfect opportunity if they really are ever going to do it.
Think of what a great public relations coup that would be for the royal family if they managed that. If they pulled that off, and they were seen being happy together again, happy together again,
it'd be incredible.
Think of what that would do.
And even more, Meghan and Kate, you know, sitting in the garden having a nice chat. You know, that would be gold for them now.
By the way, the thing
with Oprah.
I haven't seen the Emily Maitlis Netflix thing yet, but I've talked to people who have seen it, and they said that, and these are Americans, they said that the real revelation in it is how inept and out of touch the Andrew's advisors were, the whole palace communications team, and it shows the mechanics of how long and how difficult the negotiation was between Newsnight and the palace in order to get that interview. One guy said to me, it's like they lived in a different world. The BBC were in the real world and the palace were on another planet that they didn't realise.
Well, that never seems to change. I mean, that's just been going on forever, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it wasn't that the Emily Maitlis and Newsnight were setting a trap for them. They didn't set out to deliberately trap him. He trapped himself.
Yeah.
Completely.
Well, they were very trusting. I think they were so desperate to have some sort of serious vehicle to talk about things that they didn't prep him, and they basically had no one in the room to sort of say, thanks, that's enough, which you would have with a pretty minor celeb. So, yeah.
One of the telling things to me was that he said, before the interview, he said to her, is this going to be a David Frost interview? And he meant the softball David Frost that he knew, not the earlier David Frost that I worked with not just Frost Nixon, but all the stuff that David had done on British television before Frost Nixon. And Emily made this as a student of David Frost's early interviewing and the really brilliant technique he had for drawing people out. And so she realized right then that he had a different concept of the world than she did.
Well, he was friendly with David Frost, in later life. And I think he just assumed he was like that. Because also, I think having a woman there, you see it with the Selina Scott interview, you know, he's flirtatious. He's more relaxed in a way, I suspect, with a male interviewer. And I think, frankly, my own opinion is most of our best interviewers are female now because it is done much more subtly and much less adversarially as, let's say, a Piers Morgan would be.
That's a novel view, Andrew. I think it's very interesting because seduction is part of the revelation, in other words. Gentle seduction is taking place.
Yes, yes. No, I think if you look at it like that, certainly if you look at the Selina Scott interviews, you know, he was waiting to get her number. He was going to tell her everything.
Anyway, if you pull back to where we started this conversation and whether Andrew has a role to play in the future, I think absolutely not. I don't. Rehabilitation of Andrew would be a bad move, I think.
No, I agree. Well, we should have you back to review the Netflix show. there's plenty of opportunities. I mean, I'm sure series 6 or 7, where are we with the crowd? They're supposed to have stopped, but I bet they go back to it. How could they not?
How could they drop it? Mind you, it has a long afterlife. People watch it all the time, even now.
Yes. Well, they could all come back as ghosts.
We are, as ever, in your debt.
Thank you. No, it's a fascinating perspective from across the Atlantic.
There's two people I would talk to at any time because you're such astute observers of the scene and you don't take bullshit. You've got bullshit detectors of a very high.
That's going on the bio. Thank you.
That's you're going to get another mug after you've said that. What I love is that you've got this extraordinary career going back over 60 years, longer, 70 years almost.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there are very few people still active in journalism who can speak and with such a varied career who can talk. So we feel very privileged to have you talking to us.
Amen to that. And thanks again.
I've got a crew coming to interview me about David Frost in 2 weeks' time, about the early Frost. Frost Mark I, not Frost Mark II.
Right. Right. Well, it's good night for him.
And good night from him. See you, Clive.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Well, always very interesting to hear from Clive. I mean, he has such a great perspective in terms of length and in terms of his overview of everything. Very interesting to hear what might be happening to the Murdoch Empire, brought down by the royals, possibly.
That would be quite a twist, wouldn't it? Built so much of its power and influence by royal reporting, and maybe that will be one of the reasons it's fading. I mean, I suppose the fact that newspapers don't sell in anything like the numbers they used to sell is one reason. But maybe Rupert flew too close to the sun. You know, he got into an awful lot of trouble with that coverage of the American election, and that's why there's the big settlements Fox News had to pay.
Yeah, exactly. And it's extraordinary that he continued to fly so close. But that's sort of the way he is. And I mean, it's sort of the way Maxwell was. You know, it's interesting, certain themes emerge of the people we've been talking to. And also this media manipulation that we talked to Simon Weiger about. It's, you know, I don't think people realize that the news they're getting isn't necessarily what really happened.
But it's like a lot of our best interviews, actually, listening to Clive. It's like a sort of social history of, well, not just Britain, but certainly Britain and all the other countries where Murdoch's had a lot of influence. And it feels like we've sort of lived through, we're now in the sort of dying days of a great emperor who is, you know, fighting more now to keep his reputation rather than expand his empire any further.
Yes, it's with the legacy. And the legacy of some of his senior staff, because there's a danger that some of them may end up going to prison if this continues. I mean, I don't think it will happen.
Harry, it would be. I mean, it's probably still unlikely, but what would Harry have to do to make Murdoch give evidence? It's still not quite clear to me. He just has to keep you know, refusing to settle. Is that basically what he has to do?
Yeah. And he's got the deep pockets to do that. And must be always this concern about some of the evidence in other cases being used, being some of the material being released. There's been lots of debate about that. But I think there's certainly quite a lot of incriminating material used in other cases that he wants to draw on. So end of one empire. And we may be talking about another empire soon. I don't know what have we got in store next week?
I don't think we've decided. I think it's either going to be Putin or our Roman Empire and the women of the Roman Empire, which is a really fun interview, which I'd like to put out soon. We need to decide. I also need to apologise. If you're still listening, Françoise in Belgium, I really mangled your name at the beginning of the show. It's not Hermitage. It's L'Hermite, I think. Do let me know how to pronounce your name, since you've been so kind to us. And also, if you do want your mug in French, we normally have the one that says, another day, another scandal. Let me know what that phrase means in French, how you'd like
it. Or I'm feeling scandalous.
Yeah, or you can have, are you feeling scandalous? I don't know how that would translate in French. But we'd like to do something special for you, since you have for us. Because we're just so nice.
Well, a lot of those mugs going around. I gave one to a producer at ZDF the other day, who was very keen to have one. So one day we must have a group photo with all our mugs.
Yes, well, we're going to have a summer party for our guests, aren't we?
We
must ask them to all bring their mugs so we can have a sort of picture and make it even more desirable. And they are available, of course, on the bio. You can link to our shop. And while you're there, you can subscribe to this podcast. And you can also give us a couple of dollars in thank you if you feel the need.
I mean, that will help us towards our production costs. So we're still not making money, but hopefully we will be getting there soon. And yes, do press like, do give us comments. That all helps with our algorithms. Do spread the word.
Please
and
do
make suggestions.
Yep. And thank you for all your time and attention. And we'll see you soon.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.